I mean, I have to say, when I heard that, like, people actually watch this show, I was actually pretty surprised.
Return to sender. Stamp collecting happens when we dream together.
Welcome to Stamp Show Here Today, episode number 78.
I'm Cash.
I'm Tom.
I'm Scott.
And I'm your host, Dawn. This week, we'll be addressing listener emails, women in the postal system, and our expert topic is on blue paper. So, stamp news. We get emails. This one from David F. starts with, "Good morning, gentlemen." What about me? Moving right along. I have a few questions, and therefore have addressed them to the answer squad.
Oh, wow.
That's cool.
Yeah. We need to get some answer squad music, a little music clip for them.
I have a very nicely centered used Scott 572. It contains a perfin. They are not false, but were purposely applied to stamps. How do you grade perfins?
Well, first of all, this is regarding grading. So, you know, we're on a 1 to 100 scale. So what he's asking is, how many points do you get or lose for having a perfin? So, Scott?
Well, perfins are not what you normally encounter. Perfins are considered by many collectors as second-class stamps. Therefore, in the marketplace, perfins tend to bring lower prices. Therefore, the grade is lower. And so the grade is generally about two grades lower than a comparable stamp without a perfin. Now, the only exception to that is when you have revenue stamps and they are actually cataloged with a perfin cancel in the catalog. And in that case, there's no deduction for the perfin. It's just valued as a stamp with a perfin cancel.
Yes, but what's the change in the catalog? Aren't they like half the value?
A lot of times it is much more than half, much less than half.
Oh, less than half? Oh,
much
okay.
less.
Oh, okay.
You might have a $8 or a $10 stamp that with a perfin might be 30 cents.
Oh.
So it's significantly less.
Yeah, got it.
Next question. I have a nicely centered Scott 833. It contains a massive vignette shift. I acquired it for the shift. I did read that part of your grade takes into account the vignette centering. In a normal vignette stamp, the vignette can be off-center without being classified as a shift. In the stamp I have, the majority of the value will be applied to the shift since it is so pronounced. How will the grading process treat this?
First of all, in 833, that's the $5 Wilson. Is that it?
It's the $2.
Oh, the $2.
Presidential series.
$2. Who's before Wilson? Harding? I don't know my presidents. Calvin Coolidge. That's who it is. I think it's Calvin. No, Wilson's on the $1. Who comes after Wilson? I think it's Calvin Coolidge.
Anyway, as part of the grading system, vignette shifts are small shifts where the vignette shifts around and then it just appears off center. A significant vignette shift, as in this case where it would put the vignette over into the frame of the stamp, that is actually not considered a fault or a deduction. That would then be mentioned specifically with a shifted vignette on the certificate, and it would not affect the grade of the stamp.
And for our foreign listeners, vignette is the when it's printed in two colors, the middle thing, which on U.S. stamps in this period, it's usually black. That's the vignette. So we're dealing with the 1901 issue,
not necessarily, because the C-23 airmail stamp is red and blue. Special delivery stamp CE-2 is, again, the opposite, blue and red. So
yeah, C-3, if the airplane, the inverted Jenny, if it's shifted enough into the frame, then it's called a fast plane or a landed plane or a slow plane.
Or a high flyer.
Or a high flyer. And those actually have very large premiums, yeah. So once it gets freakishly off-center, then you stop going down in value and start shooting up in value.
Right.
Next question. I am selling a regummed Scott 245 that received a grade of 90. How should I value this item?
as a no-gum stamp, basically. Regum is generally gum that is not original to the stamp, has been applied to take the place of original gum. Would we value that the same as a stamp without original gum?
Personally, I've seen that they get about a $5 premium because, you know, somebody paid $5 to put the gum on the back.
Well,
but realistically, it's a no-gum stamp.
Right. And most collectors prefer to have gum on their stamps, so classic stamps do get regummed.
I have several Canal Zone 25th anniversary issues, Scott numbers 120, 135, and C15, C20. I understand why you don't grade Canal Zone, the early issues with overprints. The Canal Zone stamps that I listed are basically normal U.S. type commemoratives. Will you grade these if I send them in?
Of course. As you said, they're basically like U.S. commemorative stamps. It's a cohesive series, and the centering is, they were basically printed by the U.S. for the Canal Zone. Possessions are hot right now. Absolutely, these stamps are worth grading.
And yes, we do all the possessions, not just Canal Zone, but also Philippines and Danish West Indies and Hawaii and Guam. And as a matter of fact, Guam is one of my favorites. So.
Our next email is from Donna. And she asks, what differences, if any, are you seeing in collecting patterns geographically? Are collectors seeking different things based on where they live?
Well, I see the market up in November to March, basically the winter months. And I think that's because people tend to stay in the house more often. But I'm relating mostly to eBay. I'm going to guess that actually going to stamp shows probably drops off in the winter months because people don't want to leave the house.
Well, not in California. Anyway.
Well, in California, it doesn't matter. But, you know, if you're in, I don't know, someplace where it snows, Chicago.
Minnesota,
yeah. Probably your stamp shows cut out in the wintertime.
I don't know about that because a lot of northern cities, Chicago, New York, things along the northeast.
The Rust Belt?
Yeah. You know, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Boston, Rochester, even Denver. They all have winter shows.
Yeah.
It's something to do when you can't go outside and do anything. Although in Denver, why wouldn't you go skiing?
But yeah. Yeah, get out and do something. Go walk a dog.
Be a well-rounded individual.
Or ride a bike. Or chase cats.
Our next question is, are press sheets and no die cut issues helping or hurting the stamp hobby?
Does Tom have an opinion?
No.
Oh. Well, then I guess they aren't helping or hurting the hobby at this time. But I do find them interesting. I find it fun to try and find them used.
Oh, yeah, that's cool.
And, I mean, they are fairly difficult to find. I found one eBay seller that had a whole bunch of them, and not just one listing, but he had multiple listings of some of them, which means, obviously, he either sent or received a package with multiples on it, and he cut them very nicely. So mm-hmm. I was able to acquire a number of them from him. And I was excited when I got the envelope because it had one on it that he didn't have on the eBay. And then he included as a bonus another one that I hadn't bought. So I thought he was a really top-notch seller.
Well, I was talking to Tom about this. And in my opinion, it's a really good thing to collect because you're pretty well insured that you're going to get face value for your stamps. Probably go up. It's very hard for you to buy things now at the post office that are, let's call it, investment grade with a small I, not a capital I. And I think that the press sheets, the imperf press sheets, are one of those small I things that they will hold their value. You will probably always be able to get face for them. And the ones that are more popular will go up in value. I see that right now.
And not only that, trying to find them used now before too much time has passed, you're doing two things. One, you're ensuring that you get a contemporaneous cancel.
Yep.
And two, not a lot of them are being used.
Yeah.
A lot of them are being saved in sheets or the press sheets are being cut up into panes and saved that way. So I see it as something neat that you can add to your collection that's a little bit out of the ordinary. And as you said, will actually hold value.
And Me personally, I cut them up. I don't want to store press sheets, but I'll store the individual sheets. I'll cut out all the individuals.
Her next question, what trends do you see in the number of collectors involved in collecting and buying classic stamps?
Well, high-value stuff is bonkers. Set whatever price you want, and you'll probably get it.
Yeah, look at Siegel. Yeah.
But, I mean, that's for the really high-value and nice stuff. I mean, we're talking classic errors, mint classics, even used classics with good centering and sound.
Well, what Rich Lehman, shout out to Rich from last week, he said that basically the market is really best moving for items which are $1,000 and above.
Yes.
So, yeah, the high end and the low end, you know, like I said before, you know, junk is always going to be junk.
Right.
So the not junk, I guess, kind of by default, he said that the $1,000 up stuff is not junk. I fully believe that the number is far less than that.
I agree.
It's 100 or two, maybe.
I agree. And I would even go so far as to say maybe $50.
Yeah, yeah.
For a single item, that is.
So, yeah, I see. Well,
but it's the items that you don't see in a childhood collection.
Exactly.
Or a collection that was just built as stamps coming in off of the mail, for the most part, and bought in packets and things like that. The stamps that you had to buy individually, those are the stamps that are hot.
Well, that's one of the things that I was going to discuss on future podcasts is what's the definition between scarce and rare? And I think really what's going on is that the scarce stuff will go up, the rare stuff will go up more, and the common stuff is just always going to be common. So, you know, it's kind of where do you draw that line for scarce?
I think the uncommon stuff is kind of moving down, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
It's moving closer to the common stuff because for very little money, you can buy a collection or a grouping of items and you get some uncommon items and some common items, and they sell very inexpensively for low percentages of catalog value.
Oh, yeah.
But it's the items that you have to buy singly or in sets, complete sets, where the higher value items in the set are included. Those are the ones that are going to start to, you'll see they'll hold the value or they'll start to move up.
Yeah. But where specifically do you see like the line for scarce versus uncommon? I mean, where would you say this item is scarce and you can tell that because of the value?
I would say that's probably around the $20 or $25
Oh, that
mark.
Low?
I think so.
Oh, okay. I was going to put it up at like $100.
No, because you see single eBay lots, and they run the gamut from everything.
Oh, well.
Anything from, you know, a penny or 2 pennies a stamp.
Yeah, no,
and
no.
They're not even worth that.
No, let's go ahead. Yeah, let's talk about catalog value, because I've seen on eBay, you know, $100 stamps sell for literally $2.
Well, that's because they're in such horrible condition.
Exactly, exactly.
And so, but you're talking a market value stamp with a market value of $25 and up,
mm-hmm.
which is something that you can easily list on eBay and get $25
yeah.
for because the condition is there or the catalog value is there. I mean, you can have a $2,500 stamp and it's in such crappy condition, but it's still worth $25.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that used to be the old thing with the Zeppelins and the dollar value Colombians. No matter what, and U.S. number one, too. No matter what the condition was, you were guaranteed to get 50% of catalog. Because people just wanted those stamps so much that even if it was a doggy, ugly stamp, you'd still get half catalog. Whereas a regular issue from 1863, same catalog value, you might get just 2% or 5%
well,
of catalog or something like
and
that.
And I think part of that goes to the fact that those stamps are less popular.
Yeah, by a lot. Yeah,
by a lot. I mean, the stamps you talked about, the number one and the Zeppelins, they have topical appeal. They have mystique about them. And that's kind of what drives their desirability much more so than just catalog value.
Yeah.
I mean, you have sets of banknotes that essentially look the same.
Yeah.
I mean, the devil's in the details, but they essentially look the same. And so they're less popular than these other issues that you mentioned.
Yeah, that's got a Zeppelin on it. Ooh.
Well, yeah. I think you can go into scarce versus rare in another subject. I'll go Disney pins.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's necessarily scarce and rare are kind of the same thing, but I think it applies more to a value perspective. Because a limited edition pin, say it was 500 that were put out there, and I know this doesn't apply to all stamps. You know they're out there, they're in the hands of collectors, and you very rarely see them on the market. Those are scarce to me. There's a pin, specifically one that I've always been after, that I don't even know if one actually has ever been issued. It was a pin that was issued by the Disney store when they used to do it, not just the parks. But to get one, you had to get 25 letters, written letters, of how good you did in customer service.
Oh, whoa.
They had them in sets of five. So if you got five, you got the first pin. If you got 10, you got the next one. If you got 15, but the highest one, you had to get 25 letters. I mean, how long, first of all, does it take someone to get 25 letters of recommendation? That to me is rare.
Yeah.
Versus something you know they were issued, you know they're out there. You know, it's like the C3A to me.
There's 100.
Is a rare. That's rare. Because there's only 100 of them out there.
Mm-hmm.
Others, there may be thousands of them out there. They're scarce because they're always in the hands of collectors and technically usually not worth quite as much money as something that is truly rare. Where there's I think rare is a limited quantity.
Well, I think what you're getting at is scarce is available at a price.
Yes.
Rare is, well, generally
not available.
Not
at any
available
price.
All the time.
Yeah.
Right. So I mean, that's kind of how I would, you know, differentiate the two.
Cool.
I think that's a good.
Yeah, I like it.
Our next question: how do we promote the thrill of the hunt aspect of the stamp hobby?
Throw a gold coin in a box of stamps?
Well, no, actually, this is one that I've always loved. I think that stamp collecting, coin collecting, baseball card collecting, any collecting, you have the thrill of the hunt. And without that, you have just accumulating stamps. If you could go onto eBay and buy anything you wanted, then how big is your checkbook? And you can buy whatever you want. And I know all my favorite finds. You know, I found a U.S. number 16, 10 cent, Washington, marked as a 15.
Well, the thing is that basically it's a treasure hunt.
Yeah.
And the way that you find treasure is by learning stuff that the next guy may not know. And so you're basically just, you know, he missed it, you found it. I mean, he looked at a diamond and said, oh, it's a piece of gravel. And you looked at it and go, well, I'll take that piece of gravel because it's really a diamond.
Mm-hmm.
And so then when you turn around and sell it, you say, well, this is a diamond. And everybody else looks at it and goes, hey, yeah, that's a diamond.
Yeah, my favorite, too, the 702B, the dark lake.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
But the person walked up at the stamp show and said, hey, look what I found. And he bought it for $5 on eBay, and it's worth $2,500. That's cool, you know, stuff like that.
But, you know, he happened to get lucky on that one. That wasn't really through education or
research. Well, actually, it was.
He did a little bit, and he was able to recognize that it didn't look normal.
Right.
But he didn't know, really, it didn't register how, you know, how different it really was. And I mean, it's great for him. I mean, I love to hear stories where people find stuff. And I mean, I've got stories of my own where I've found stuff. And
what's your best find?
My best find was a 11 cent Washington Franklin perf 11, but it actually turned out to be perf 10 at the bottom.
You have a compound perf. I remember you telling me about it.
It was in a plate block of six. And so I bought the whole block. Well, all three stamps on the bottom were perf 10 at the bottom. So here I have an item that's not even listed in the catalog as a plate block. And I've got three of them. And I mean, I bought it for 10% of what it was worth. I paid $125. And It was just a home run.
Yeah.
Really, realistically. And the funny thing was, the same week, I was looking at 599 coil stamps, which is a type one, just a Fourth Bureau rotary press coil stamp, the 2 cent.
Common Washington.
Common. And I found a line pair that was a combination type one and type two.
Those are cool, yeah.
It's really cool. They're really hard to find. It was used, and it was just kind of in a big pile of stuff.
Yeah.
It was the same week that I found both of those. It was like I hit treasure hunt heaven.
Oh. Tom, have you found anything great?
I'm not the big stamp collector here, as much as sounds weird. I think my biggest kind of thrill of the hunt was a long time ago. My dad had a Victorian house out in Pennsylvania, and the guy that owned the house before him was a gemologist. And he taught classes on cutting and polishing in the basement of the house. And I came to find out that this guy had so much stuff that he would just dump piles out in the yard. My dad had 2 acres. There were places I would go, I'd be like doing some weeding or something on the side and come across this pile of dirt, dig into it, and finding tiger's eye, amethyst, all sorts of these crazy things. And it's like, I'd spend half my summers when I was out there digging through piles of dirt looking for these, you know, not really necessarily even semi-precious stones. They weren't like high quality. But I still have those today.
That's real treasure hunting. Mm-hmm.
That was real treasure hunting for me. I mean, it's not worth a lot of money, but it was a lot of fun. And that's, you know, that's where you get the thrill of the hunt, is when you find something. You know, again, in hunting for something doesn't have to be the expensive thing. You know, sometimes it's like, hey, I've got all of this set. I just can't find the 5 cent. It just seems that nobody in my area has it, and nobody on eBay has it listed. And it's like, you know, it takes you 5 years to finally finish your set. You have to hunt for it. And that's
I had an item like that. It was part of my modern collection. I collect joint issues with foreign countries, with the U.S., and the U.S. had issued a joint issue with Italy. And I could find the stamp used, but it took me over 8 years to find a 40-cent stamp. Mm-hmm. And the thrill of the hunt was I got the same adrenaline rush when I walked up and asked the dealer, and he says, yes, I have one. I held it out for you because you've been asking me every time, 3 or 4 times a year when I saw him. And he ended up just giving it to me because it was a 40-cent stamp. But the adrenaline rush was just as if when I found that plate block of stamps. It was just, it's the thrill of the hunt. It doesn't really matter what the value is. It's being able to say, wow, I finally found this.
I had the same thing. I collect used. And I had Scott's Platinum albums. And I collected, you know, from U.S. number one all the way up to, I think it was like 1997, and I didn't buy any other pages. But once you hit the regular issues, I would buy a collection, and there would be stamps, and I'd fill it all in. I might find, you know, 100 stamps, 200 stamps at a time to put in. But getting used, like, booklet singles of some common 1 cent stamp, you just couldn't find it. It was too cheap for anybody to carry or anybody to care about, and you couldn't find them. They were just gone, you know, wherever they were. And so every time I found one of those, I was really happy. Nothing great, nothing of value, and I ended up selling the collection. But, you know, just trying to find these things is pretty cool.
Well, it's funny. I know Scott at one point had a lot of, like, naval covers. I mean, what if you're one of those people that you won't, I want to collect cancels from all of the U.S. naval vessels from World War II, and I've got all of them but this one boat. And it's like, how long are you going to spend? I mean, even if it's a cheap dollar, $2 cover, and it's like, I have an entire set of U.S. naval ship cancels or covers, whatever it may be, but I just need one last one. And it's like, how long is it going to take you to find? Because you're now looking for not just a naval cover. You're looking for a particular ship from a particular time.
Well, I've been looking for chicken stamps now for, what, 2 years?
same thing.
I have never seen a commercial usage of a chicken stamp.
Chicken stamp on from a chicken industry?
Oh, I would love to find one from like Tyson Foods, and I'm sure they're out there or something like that. But I just can't find, you know, I find First Day covers all over the place. And I'll find one that, you know, is addressed from, you know, some handwritten signature or something on a nothing cover. I have not seen any of those on a commercial cover. And God, if I found one on a actual chicken company, oh, that would be the greatest thing in the world.
But even though it's only probably a $2 item.
Or
less.
A 25-cent item.
Yeah.
But, you know, I pick up all the chicken stuff I can. And that one, I just cannot find that stamp on anything that's non-philatelic that looks nice. It just doesn't exist.
Well, the Chicken Alaska cancels. Now, those were pretty cool,
oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, Chicken Alaska, that was fun. I found a couple of those. And then we did the research on what it was.
You didn't find them. They were both sent to you.
No. One of, yeah.
It was us. Yeah. We went to a stamp show in San Diego.
Yep.
And guy had, I wish you remember his name, but he had several covers with the cancels on it.
Mm-hmm. And he had actually been to Chicken Alaska. So
showed
he,
us pictures of Chicken Alaska.
Yeah, he told us all about it and how it got its name and everything. It's like, wow, okay. Mm-hmm. I just learned everything about something that I've been collecting for 2 years and had no clue about.
Now you have to go on a search and find out how many more cities in the world have chicken in the name.
Yeah, yep.
Or at least in the U.S. That'd be like if you had the celebration of the chemicals stamp. That's a weird stamp.
Yes, yeah.
On like a Dow
or DuPont
cover.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you know that in 1948. The chicken stamp came out, and the chicken companies all said, hey, yeah, there's a chicken stamp, let's buy some. And they sent mail out with it. All we have to do is find it.
Oh, I'm sure it's out there.
Oh, I'm sure it is, too.
Maybe I'll actually get some free time to look in New York.
Oh, yeah.
And our last question. People tend to focus on what is wrong with the stamp hobby and how it is not like it used to be. What are some new trends in the hobby that can provide encouragement? I think it's a great question.
I think it's a terrible question. I honestly hear nothing of people saying what's wrong with the stamp hobby. I do not hear people saying, oh, you know, this is bad or that's bad.
I hear people complaining that, oh, it's dying, but I don't hear about people saying, oh, stamp hobby sucks because.
Well, yeah. And the stamp collecting hobby is dying, and it has been dying since what, 1926 or something like that?
I think you're off by a few decades. 1880s.
So it's been dying for like the last 150 years.
130,
130 years. Yeah, if those people who ever hear that, you know. You should pull up some of the old magazines from the 1920s and 1930s, and they're all talking about where are the new collectors coming. It's like,
but
they came.
in the 20s, that was before Franklin Roosevelt. When Franklin Roosevelt became president, we had a big surge in stamp collecting. But then, you know, after the 1960s and 70s, stamp collecting became less popular in favor of other hobbies.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's when people started saying it's dying again.
The APS hit their big high of, what, 55,000 members?
Something like that.
In the mid-1980s.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Well, that's when stamps again were hot. There was a big bubble.
Yeah.
And then in the late 80s, it burst. And stamp prices plummeted. And that's really when you start to hear people say, well, it's dying.
Yeah.
Well, but it's not. It just, there was a big investment bubble and it burst.
Well, in the 1970s, you had, 8 million new people who claimed to be stamp collectors entering in People's Republic of China. So, like, over a period of just a couple of years, you get 8 million new stamp collectors. That's not a dying hobby.
No, absolutely not.
And so you might say, well, you know, yes, stamp collecting is dying in Coalinga, California, because the two stamp collectors who were there left. But realistically, if you take it as worldwide, and it really, with the internet, it really is worldwide.
Oh, absolutely.
There are far more stamp collectors now than at any other time in history. So, you know, and that goes to the second part. What has changed? And it's like, yeah, the internet, duh.
Exactly.
I mean, even television probably had a big pump on it when, you know, TV came up. People talked about stamp collecting and people started collecting. Now we take television for granted and everything is internet. You know, after the internet, something else will take over. We'll have 3D TV stamp collecting shows or something.
We'll have Star Trek teleporters.
Yeah, there you go. So I reject this question on the basis of I don't hear people saying that there's anything wrong.
Well, that's the first half. What are some new trends in the hobby that provide encouragement?
Oh,
and
well,
that would be encouragement to collecting.
Yeah, the ability to buy anything on eBay.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's not just eBay. You have Delcamp. You have the online auctions, a lot of which are available through Stamp Auction Network. And that's not just here in the States. That's worldwide.
Yeah. You have trade groups that are on the blog sites.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I'll send you 10 of my Australian stamps for your 10 Czechoslovakian stamps. You know, that happens all the time now on the internet. Okay. Yeah, what can we do to encourage it? Know that it's there.
Yeah, and to that point, I mean, usually when I interact with people who are not stamp collectors, everybody, when they first meet, what do you do? And they all find it fascinating that I work for a company that plays with stamps.
Yeah.
I mean, we look at stamps all day long, and there's a lot of history, and there's a lot of things like that. And people, almost without exception, are very interested. They find it interesting. And I don't know if anybody has been converted to being a stamp collector other than Tom here.
Mm-hmm.
But they do find it interesting. They just have never been exposed to it. And I think that's one of the things that maybe is a goal, should be a goal, is to just expose people to how interesting and how fun and entertaining it can be.
Well, I mean,
that's our goal here at the podcast.
Yeah, just be realistic with the podcast. That's what we do. You know,
we talk about it. We share our experiences.
Yeah.
And we share one of the things that we enjoy doing.
And when it first started, you know, people were saying, oh, you're going to do one on stamp collecting. Well, that should be good for about 10 episodes, and then you'll run out of stuff to say. And we're on episode number 78, and we got scripts out the wazoo that we haven't even addressed yet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
It's time for hashtag stamp stories. Women in the early postal service. Women's roles in the early U.S. Postal Service are difficult to identify. Official records documenting their involvement are rare. Their participation experiences were more commonly communicated through oral narratives and observations by higher-level officials. Given that post offices in the early and colonial America shared space with general stores and printing businesses, the wife or female members of the household who assisted in these shops performed postal duties as well. Even Benjamin Franklin enlisted the help of his wife at his post office in Philadelphia. Women were not always handling the mail directly, but they helped keep the system running. When post riders arrived to change horses and to pick up and deliver mail, women most likely provided them with provisions and lodging. Other early American women acquired postal positions indirectly. They might continue their spouse's postal duties after their spouse had moved on to other career opportunities or passed away. During the Revolutionary War, women temporarily managed printing or postal work while their husbands, sons, or fathers fought in the war. In the early 1800s, women were prohibited from holding clerkship in the general post office. In fact, any postmaster who would be so daring as to appoint a woman as a clerk would be cited as a cause for his dismissal. However, women continued to unofficially assist their postmaster husbands, brothers, or sons with clerical work. Although postal records listing their names and posts are hard to find, there are occasional references to their involvement. If you want to read more about this on women in the early U.S. postal history, go to the Smithsonian National Postal Museum.
Online, I assume you mean. Online. As opposed to actually going there.
Why not?
Or you can go there, too.
Or go there, too. Sure.
It's a short train ride from New York City.
Yeah.
There you go.
No, I like when you were doing the research, there was one unmarried woman who was delivering the mail. And it was scandalous.
Ooh, shocking.
Ooh, oh, no, an unmarried woman delivering mail. What can we expect?
And what else is she delivering?
Yeah, where was that, Chicago in like the 1890s or something like that? Mm-hmm. You know, we look back at it now and go, what the hell were they thinking? But, you know, some people back then had an opinion about it.
Well, I mean, you know, a woman's role has always been, you know, they take care of hearth and home.
Yeah, and host podcasts.
Oh, that's right. I'm an unmarried woman hosting a podcast. Oh, that's scandalous.
Get out the pitchforks. Burn her at the stake.
Again.
The main portion of my aunt's entire career was for the post office.
Really?
And on that note.
Actually,
it's just a statement.
I have an uncle that's a mail carrier.
Well, you know, I drive to pick up the mail, and when I drive down the driveway, they're all loading up their trucks, and half of them are men and half of them are women, and nobody gives a crap either way. You know, they all just deliver the mail. But, yeah, that one unmarried woman in Chicago delivering the mail unescorted or something is like, oh, no.
Well, it's a different society. You know, my wife comes from the Philippines, and when they go out on dates and things like that, it's always a group affair. You never see couples out by themselves.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, but do they deliver the mail?
Maybe not.
Are they progressive enough to have women, unmarried women delivering the mail?
I don't know about mail delivery, but my sister-in-law does work for the government in doing something.
Oh.
She has an office.
Scandalous.
Yeah. You know, 150 years ago, 200 years ago, yeah, it would have been scandalous.
Yes, very. And now time for Cash's corrections. Cash, you have a very important correction here.
I have two very important, actually three, but one hasn't been confirmed yet. Steve P. sent me an email, the Charlton Heston stamp, which has a guy that looks like Spartacus on it. Actually, that's not Spartacus. That's Ben-Hur. So I apologize to Charlton Heston and Ben-Hur, by the way, if he's listening. The second one, which I haven't been able to confirm, but it came from him, so I'm going to trust that he's correct. I said that Åland was part of Denmark, and it's not. It's part of Finland. So the most beautiful stamp of 2015 from Åland is from part of Finland. The third one is when we mentioned the Pluto souvenir sheets, there's an extra stamp there. And I said it was the Hubble telescope. That's really before I saw the stamp. I knew that there was a thing there, and I just called it Hubble telescope. When I looked at it, it's obviously a radio telescope, and it is obviously the New Horizons space probe. So, oops, there's three for me. But on the upside, anybody who wants to collect the 2015 issues of Angola, Afghanistan, Burundi, Congo, Djibouti, Eritrea, Gabon, Haiti, Jamaica, Lesotho, Mauritania, Nauru, Peru, which is surprising, Rwanda, Seychelles, Somalia, South Sudan, Sudan, Swaziland, and Yemen, you all have a complete 2015 collection because they issued no stamps. I found that rather interesting that there are countries, and quite a few of them, that issued zero stamps in 2015.
Obviously, there was a postal need.
So you can say, I have a complete collection of the 2015 stamps of Congo and have no stamps. The last one is, we have launched the Stamp Show Here Today YouTube. Go there, check out some stuff. Remember that the first five episodes of Everything in the World suck. So please be kind to us, but give us your feedback on what you see and what you want to have us address. We did this because a lot of times on the podcast, we'll discuss things. that we can't show because this is an audio show. So on the podcast, though, we can show pictures. And so that's why we put it up. And that's it.
Oh, my God. Who the hell cares?
And now our expert topic, blue paper. So, Scott, what is blue paper? And don't say it's paper that's blue.
Well, you kind of took the wind out of my sails there. No, it's not blue paper. What it is they, when they made the, in the paper making process, they were trying to reduce shrinkage of the paper after the stamps were printed and before perforation. And so what they did is they added 15% rag stock to the wood pulp in the paper making process. And at the time, a lot of the rags were dyed blue. So that's why it's called blue paper. But the paper is actually a sort of grayish color. And it is best viewed when you place a normal stamp face down on an orange background. Mm-hmm. You can find those as post-it notes, or sometimes you get sheets from the paper store that are bright neon orange color. And blue and orange are opposite on the color wheel. Six colors, primary, go all the way back to grade school here.
Science stuff.
Yeah. And but it brings out the difference in the paper appearance. And so when you put these two together next to each other, you'll notice that one has basically a whitish or an off-white look to it, and the other kind of really does look bluish. That's the effect that the orange background has to it. The basis for it is that they added the rag stock to the paper-making process.
And you put them face down because?
You put them face down because a stamp is printed in a color of ink. Well, you don't want that color to interfere with your perception of what the paper looks like in the background of the stamp. So by placing it face down, you've taken that color out of your perception, and now you're only looking at the paper.
Which here at PSE, the most common thing we get is the 5-cent stamp, which is printed blue.
Yes.
And so people go, whoa, well, this is a blue stamp. It's like, nah. It's
Yes, you also get that. But on a blue stamp, you also get plate wash, where in between printings, the plate wasn't completely wiped clean. So you get a light film of blue ink over the entire surface of the stamp on the printed side. By flipping it upside down, you don't have that. Another thing you might want to note with bluish paper is a lot of times you can find these stamps and they're re-gummed and sold as bluish paper. Be very careful, because once the gum is removed, now you can put it in a bowl of water that has blue dye in it, and that will actually leach into the fibers of the paper and make it look blue. Well, obviously they're trying to make it what they think is blue paper. One of the tells on that is the loose perforation fibers around the perforations will actually soak up more dye than the rest of the stamp. And so you'll get this bright blue edge around on the perforations that is different from the rest of the stamp. You should have none of that on a genuine blue paper stamp.
That's like when my daughter just did a science thing with flowers, when you stick like a white carnation in a blue dyed water and all the tips of the carnation will turn blue.
Well, I've also seen where I'll be soaking Christmas cards, and there will be a blue piece of paper in there.
Right.
And it'll give everything inadvertently a blue tint.
Or red or green.
Or red or green or everything else, yeah.
Those really heavily dyed envelopes.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that when you see a blue paper stamp, if you look at it and it's actually blue, then you know it's fake. Because blue paper isn't really blue paper. Like Scott said, it's gray paper.
Right. So if you have stamp questions, send us a picture at bluepaper@gradingmatters.com, and we'll take a look at it. We'll see what we can see from a photo. A lot of times we can tell things from the photo. Other things we can't.
I don't want you to plug that for everybody, because we just got three pictures today where a person sent us and said, are these the expensive varieties? And we said, no, unfortunately not. You know, but it sure as hell saved him a bunch of money from having to ship it any cert fees.
This was a non-collector, and he thought he had an imperforate sheet of stamps. So he sent us a picture, and it was clearly perforated. It was very easy for us to educate him and say, no, this is not the expensive variety. This is just a normal variety. And we were able to help him out with that. You never know what you're going to get in these emails. And so we just try and do our best when we look at them. And if we can't answer your question, then we'll let you know that and that it needs to be looked at in person.
And people do find blue paper stamps
absolutely.
All the time.
If you think you have a blue paper stamp, send us two photos, one on an orange background if you can find it, and then one on a normal white background.
Yeah, we can't expertise it via an email. We actually have to have it in our hand.
Right, but a lot of times we can rule out things and say, well, this does not look promising. Am I blue?
Thank you for joining us for episode 78. This has been Cash, Scott, Tom, and I'm your host, Dawn. You can reach us with your questions or comments at stampshowheretoday@gmail.com, Twitter at stampshowht, or leave a message on our Google Voice number 1-949-873-4298. You can also check out our website at stampshowheretoday.com or follow us on Facebook. And as always, keep collecting.
Hi, this is Bob Prager with Gary Poser Incorporated, and we're in Long Island, New York, and New Jersey, and our philosophy at Gary Poser Incorporated is this. We would rather pay very fair prices on 9 out of 10 collections that we look at versus trying to just offer very low prices on 1 out of 2 and making a big score. That's never our philosophy. So if you want to be treated fairly, please give us a call anytime at 800-323-4279, and again, my name is Bob Prager.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurfs, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today. Address unknown.